Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the April 19th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my friends and colleagues at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my real friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's shocked to find out he's my real friend. He's an economist, an author, and the host of the Capital Record podcast and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Will, it is so loud in my ear.
Is it too loud?
No, it's, well, yeah, it is, but I'll fix it. But it wasn't like you said anything I didn't like. I loved it. I'm just going to turn down the volume.
Brian's going to turn this down a little bit.
There you go.
Okay, is that better?
This is my IT skill is very similar to my home projects. I don't change my own light bulbs, and I apparently couldn't turn down the volume on my headset. So this is what we're dealing with here.
Well, I'm glad that Brian just did it because I probably would have cranked through your tympanic membrane.
I have a group of guys I go to Vegas with each year for March Madness. They're long, long, long time friends, good buddies. And this week, one of them who is an attorney and a friend of mine, he's a real handyman. He built a big tree house for his kids. He lived in my neighborhood years ago. And he was talking to my other friends, some of whom I've known for like 30 plus years, about how whenever I needed something done, I'd call him and they were making fun of me. And then my friends turned and said, like, you still don't even have a toolbox? And I said, by the way, I have a screwdriver, both kinds, the one with the four things, which is called a Phillips, and another one that's normal. And I thought, like, I was bragging, like, I showed them I know what's up. And they just thought I was the idiot who God let walk through the door. So, yeah, I'm glad we have our volume set. And, Will, it's good to be with you in studio in California. Beautiful weather.
Isn't it
here
great?
We are.
Yeah. Hey, we got a bunch of letters. I'm going to just read a couple of them real quickly. We got this one from our friends Byron and Janie Snap. In the recent episode, David said no hearers cared what he's doing. On this point, I take issue. As two who knew his father and hosted him in our home, we love to see generational faithfulness of children and of God's blessing on their work in these economic times. I can't imagine the weight of that David carries on his shoulders regarding faithfully stewarding his clients' money and keeping up with his other responsibilities. Enjoy the breadth of stories covered on the podcast. We only wish you all had more listeners in Sacramento who would take these comments to heart.
Well, thanks. That's very, very, very nice.
It is very sweet.
And very appreciated.
And then you might remember a couple of weeks ago, we talked about U.S. Postal Service in reference to the Pony Express.
Well, yeah, I asked anyone to write me if they were.
We got lots of letters. I'm serious.
We got lots of letters from people who said, I listen to Radio Free California and I'm in the post office.
They're letter carriers.
They're letter carriers.
Yes.
They're a mailman.
They're a mailman. These are all mailmen.
Okay, hold on. Lots? Really lots? Like,
we got five. Here's two.
That's a lot.
Because they all said, I'm a letter carrier and I listen. So here's Tommy, the mailman, who says, keep up the great work, fellas. I actually read There's No Free Lunch while delivering the mail. So he was listening while walking around, right? And then Will, the mailman, says, I'm listening to the latest Radio Free California right now. And after a few jabs at the USPS, David said he'd be interested to hear how many listeners do, in fact, work for the post office.
Wait, what was my jabs at the USPS?
Oh, we were just joking about the fact that the Pony Express is...
Oh, there's... Yeah, okay.
It was a joke.
That's true.
It was a joke, yeah. So he says he's taken a quick break from his route to drop us a line. He's a mailman in Belmont, California. Been listening since probably 2017 or early 2018. I listen every week. Thank you, Will, the mailman. And never miss an episode in the uber blue Bay Area. It's nice to know the entire state isn't nuts. In answer to David's question, there's a couple of tiers of employee, but for the career employees, which is most of us letter carriers, 8 hours is the baseline, though overtime is optional and sometimes mandatory. So depending on manning in an average week, I work about 45, 50 hours, most of it listening to podcasts, audiobooks, and I love him for this, NHL games. Anyway, really enjoy the show. Keep up the great work on the podcast and the California Policy Center. Nick Sayer says, regarding your prediction that Newsom's going to be the Democrats' nominee for president in 24, nothing would make him happier. It would lay bare the hypocrisy of their identitarian claims, at the same time allowing the Republican candidate to hold up California as the example of what you can expect from Newsom's leadership. Never mind the only way he gets the nod over the figurative corpses of Joe and Kamala after what could be only the most toxic primary campaign in the history of the Republic.
Well, by the way, though, just to be clear, I did not say there'd be a primary fight on this.
No, you were just saying he will end up being the guy.
So what to say they're going to have a toxic primary fight and then Gavin either prevails or doesn't prevail, There's certainly going to be a toxic primary fight, but I didn't say it would be a Biden or Kamala.
No.
I think the point, my theory would actually, I didn't add this detail, but I'm happy to now. I don't, if Biden is to run, then they have to nominate him.
Mm-hmm.
But Biden will not and cannot run if they're not going to nominate him. You see?
Yes.
You see
mm-hmm.
the, okay. Sure. So my point being, there won't be a fight between Biden and Gavin. If I'm right that Gavin's going to win, because Biden won't run.
Yes.
He'll step down for medical reasons or whatever the case is. Can we go back real quickly to the five postal workers?
Mm-hmm.
I think we did this all wrong.
Tell me.
I said I would like those of you who work for the post office to write us. Sounds like I should have said any of you don't work for the post office. Because it sounds like we have more listeners who work for the post office than don't.
Well, it's in fairness, my...
That's not true. We do have more than 10 listeners.
My guy, Pete the Mailman, is a... I would say he's probably a liberal, a moderate Democrat based on our conversations.
Pete, your guy, meaning your mailman?
My mailman. Pete
you
the mailman.
Have talks with your mailman?
I do occasionally. If I happen to be going in or out of the house, or if it's particularly hot, you know, I always make sure that there's a little ice chest out front for Pete the mailman, because it gets, you know, it gets pretty gnarly
really?
Out there in the summer. Yeah.
That's very thoughtful of you.
Well, I also take in little Mormon guys who, you know, white shirts, black ties. If it's really super hot, invite the kids in, tell them, look, I'm
give
not
them a
really,
cold beer.
or an iced coffee. No, they're always sweet.
Oh, yeah, they don't drink caffeine. I always forget about
they're
that.
They're always sweet kids. And I just feel like, you know, they're doing God's work, too. They're out mm-hmm. there. No, I'm serious. Look, we can have disagreements about doctrine. I understand
well,
that.
Well, we can, and we do. But when you, but you're...
Mine is different. Mine
when
is,
you say they're doing God's work, that means you're taking a side in the doctrine.
No, it means
the
that
point,
I...
They're either doing God's work or they're not, depending on what you believe about the doctrine.
Okay, fair enough.
But it is, as a figure of speech goes, they're perfectly pleasant people, and to provide them a cold iced tea...
No tea.
You can't even do tea.
No,
without
caffeine.
Well,
I mean, I could do
is
decaf.
Is there caffeine-free iced tea?
Yeah, sure. I suppose
so
I could
do
that.
So when I drink iced tea, it has caffeine?
All the time, brother. Oh, that would account
no
for
idea.
So much. That's why you're stroking out half the time.
Oh, my gosh.
So anyway, it's more parental than anything else, knowing that, you know, all of us who have had children, I can't say that. I have the experience since having children that all children are my children to some extent, and that I owe them that
thing. Something, man. I do not have that problem.
Okay, there we go. no, I just really sort of feel like if, you know, my kids are all over the planet, and I'm so grateful every once in a while when they
yeah.
tell me some, you know, especially when they were younger, when some older person stepped up to take care of them in some way, to help them out, to show them, you know, the ropes or whatever.
Yeah.
My son who's in the Army, when he first went in there, he was surrounded by lots of older people who really showed him the ropes. And it wasn't about their politics or his beliefs. It was just they were older. They mentored him.
Yeah.
And I hope to
well, I think that's very, very kind. Okay, so we did the post office thing, and then the other issue was...
Newsom in 24.
Yeah, so what's your take there? Do you think... I don't think it's necessary to make the case Newsom becomes Democrat nominee by saying he goes into a fight with Harris, if anything, or Biden, for that matter. The Biden thing's a non-starter.
Right, because if he is nominated, he gets the nod automatically.
Yeah, they can't. The whole point of they can't let Biden be the nominee means they can't let Biden run to be the nominee.
Right.
Okay, now with Harris, let's say that Harris decides, nope, I want to be president. Yeah. Biden's not running. Yeah. I'm the VP. This is obvious. And they can't talk her down. Well, yeah, then I guess there could be a big, nasty primary fight that she would clearly lose. But again, there's a self-fulfilling prophecy to this. She can't go run if she knows she's going to get smoked. And she's going to get smoked. But she's not going to get smoked or think she's going to get smoked if there's not a Gavin Newsom mm-hmm. out there who's already laid the groundwork. So what I'm getting to is that a lot of the conflict that the letter writer is talking about gets avoided because of the – in other words, the conflict is what you're seeing now by them hammering her in the press all the time and by them – by clearly what I consider to be collusion between the Biden administration mm-hmm. and the Newsom administration to take Kamala out at the mm-hmm. knees
mm-hmm. –
we're never going to get to find out how Kamala does man to man with Gavin Newsom, because it will be a preset situation. That's my theory.
Yeah, I agree with everything you say. I do wonder if Kamala Harris has the either clarity of mind or the intent maybe integrity to look at her chances of winning squarely, candidly, with a jaundiced eye, neutral. Because it seems to me that this is a person, I've said this before on the show, this is a person whose ambition has overreached her grasp dramatically all the time. We've talked about this ad nauseum. I've had a couple of listeners tell me slash us that we had to lay off Kamala. It's unseemly. But the fact is, this is a person who is...
Because it was too obvious or because we were being unfair?
That, you know, just banging on her all the time gets old. And my own sense is, as long as she is the vice president of the United States of America and representing us in, you know, prominent and some would say, unprecedented kinds of moments in recent history... We have a responsibility to let other people know who she is, and we've known this for decades.
You could really make a plausible argument that we have not nearly dealt with Kamala enough.
Mm. Well, so here there are some-
and by the way, the quantity is not really the issue. If we were bashing Kamala by talking all the time about how her hair is funny or something stupid like trivial like that, then whether it was one comment or 1 hour of comments, I'd be sympathetic that. It's juvenile. It's beneath us. It's not helpful. I don't think we've ever done an ad hominem attack against Kamala.
Except for the varying pronunciations of her name. I'll acknowledge.
I'm telling you right now that I swear from the bottom of my heart, I disagree. Because my point in that debate was that I was echoing her own staff.
Yes.
That I hear constantly different pronunciations from her people on the name. So it struck me as odd that they said, that senator in Georgia's being,
disrespectful
by pronouncing her name wrong, and then they play like 12 different pronunciations.
Right. That's true. Fair enough.
But all that to say, she was the senator of California who was running for president when we started Kamala Corner and became the vice president. I am sorry, but that's fair game. We're running a political podcast, which is number 26 political podcast in Uganda.
It's huge in Uganda.
Did you get my text yesterday?
I did not.
Oh, it was on WhatsApp.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I thought you were totally kidding. I did. Yeah.
We are the number 26 podcast in Uganda. I swear I'm telling the truth. This is not a joke. For those of you listening and think, like, I can't ever tell if David's being serious or not. I'm often not being, but I try to make it clear. But I am being 100% serious. I kept the data.
Dang it. Did you email it to me?
The RFC group.
I don't see it. All right, I'll go look for it.
That shows how much... You know the thread where Brian and Glenn tell us like our links and what we're talking
about? Oh, it's on WhatsApp.
It's on WhatsApp.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I have to go get that, yeah.
Number 26 political podcast in Uganda, Radio Free California. And by the way, the week before we were number 25. We fell off a bit last week.
We did.
So I'm thinking about what we could do to
re-energize the Ugandan base. Yeah.
But my point is that we have a responsibility of a political podcast. Not just responsibility. This is what we do. It's just a tautology. What are you doing talking politics? Mm. I'm doing politics on a podcast. Kamala is the problem here. She makes the people in her camp want to go after her, and then the people outside the camp want to go after her. I really believe that we've gone after Gavin Newsom more than we've gone after Kamala Harris.
Yeah. So speaking of Kamala, you and I talked a few weeks ago. You might remember I went through and I was trying to find out, like, what happened to her? She went to Poland. She was talking to NATO leaders. And then she seemed to drop off the map. And you might remember I went through a few headlines where she was showing up at, like, you know, back pocket Mississippi or something, or, you know, afterthought Louisiana to go talk to small communities and chambers of commerce.
Will apologizes in advance for his condescending attitude towards Louisiana, Mississippi, and recognizes that that's how we got Trump.
Booyah. So interestingly, it's almost as if Politico was listening, or maybe the Politico reporter here is based in Uganda. But
either Uganda or California.
One of the two. Here's the headline for the Politico story. Kamala Harris keeps traveling to unconventional places. Here's why. And this is an attempt to turn on its head my sort of narrative there with Kamala, which was the Biden White House does not know what to do with her. Every time she walks out the front door, she steps on a lawn rake. It's nothing but lawn rakes for Kamala Harris. So they sent her, I said, you know, basically off stage to go deal in these low profile places, maybe to get, it's like sending somebody down from the majors to a minor league team, you know? Maybe she needs to get her swing back, her pitching velocity up. But in any case, it's a really fascinating piece because it turns that whole thing on its head. No. This is driven by Harris because she wants to reach the common man and woman out there. And so here's the nut graph. The swing to Greenville is part of an undernoticed strategy for the VP's office, one in which she's, I think they mean honed, her focus on the ways in which administration policy is intersecting with overlooked communities. It's brought her to other far-off non-traditional locales, including a recent swing to, I kid you not, Sunset, Louisiana, a rural town of fewer than 3,000 people, to tout the administration's work expanding rural broadband. And it's manifested itself in the ways in which she's approached some of the White House's big ticket items. Here's the real important line. Weeks after the bipartisan infrastructure bill was passed into law, Harris convened a briefing with administration officials to go over part of the bill related to charging stations for electric vehicles. And what follows, David, in this story is a breathless account of Kamala Harris drilling her subordinates for information on how we are going to get rural charging stations set up in poor communities so people could drive their electric vehicles and transition to the new economy. It was as if to say, look at how smart and hardworking and grassroots Kamala is. It's a story that had to have been written by her best friends inside her campaign. Here's another wonderful line. The electoral benefits of going to remote communities in non-swing states seem decidedly limited for those inside the Beltway, especially at a time when the White House is trying to turn around its polling nosedive and gain praise for the state of the jobs market. But administration officials contend that the symbolism of a vice presidential trip matters, and that when it's tied with some larger announcement, here's my favorite phrase, it has clear downstream upside. Clear downstream upside.
Oh, that's right. Good. Well written.
So, that's Kamala. And so where is she now? Where is she this week? I went back and I looked at all the big Kamala hits. The biggest story, I found 12 different stories, and they are everywhere on the planet. It is about her playing of the, have you followed the sort of the new puzzle game Wordle? Do you know about this one?
It's funny. I only know about Wordle because of Kamala, because I've read press coverage.
Yes.
About how fascinating they are that she's admitted to being into Wordle then I was like, do I need to know what this is? And honestly, I stopped myself and I said, when I was a child, I thought like a child, yes. Reasoned like a child. And when I became a man, I put away childish things. And for all the people that do Wordle and say, what's wrong with this guy? It's just for fun. It's not a big deal. Why is he calling me childish? Understand, I'm not really saying that.
No.
I am totally saying that. You know, I sat on an airplane the other day, and I swear to you, I'm sitting there working, have my computer out, I had a book, I was trying to get a reading thing done. This guy next to me is a grown adult, was playing a video game with like a cat that was chasing like a thing, and then he had to jump over. I don't even know how to explain it. For like hours.
It's a new Activision game called Call of Kitty. It's a single shooter game with a cat that kills mice with a gun.
What is this situation with a grown adult on an airplane playing a video game for two or 3 hours?
I can't slip inside that man's brain. I can only imagine that it's been a tough, tough week for that fella.
But you can acknowledge that Paul in the New Testament wrote about it.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So back to Wordle.
This is, I think, again, there are these stories, you know, here it was Politico trying to kind of recontextualize her new pattern of going to almost unnamed and forgotten places, which, God bless you, man, if I could be VP and travel down, you know, do road trips, I might actually love that. But that it does seem like there might be more important things for her to do, but she has bungled everything she has been handed. And then this story comes out that's everywhere about how human she is, that she's just like us, but maybe smarter. I'll put the story up in the show notes. The originator of the story was called The Ringer. I don't know who The Ringer is, and I apologize. I'm going to be reprimanded for this. But the headline is, I have 100%, she says, of like winning on this game, and I intend to keep it that way. So it sounds like, you know, she's making this bold global declaration. There's a war in Ukraine. Our southern border's jacked up. Education is in free fall. Her poll numbers are lower than Biden's, which are pretty darn low.
Yeah.
And it says here, the word will craze us at the VP's office, but there's a problem. She can't send anyone her squares, which is letting people know how you're doing.
All right. I got to say something. I'm sorry. Please. I was going to let this thing go.
You're not going
to. I have a bigger criticism than what you do.
Okay.
You're criticizing her being into Wordle when it's so trivial and there's important things happening. And here's my criticism. She's lying.
Hmm. You think?
Oh, I know.
Tell me.
I can't stand the efforts politicians go to normalize themselves, what they call in the business, to humanize oneself.
Them, right.
This reeks of just utter BS.
Yes, 100%.
So there's the point of like, come on, what are you doing playing Wordle? We got to go like get Ukraine help and we have to solve for inflation and all this stuff. And my thing is, actually, it's worse than that. She's not dealing with Wordle when there's serious things going on. She's faking that she's dealing with Wordle when there's stuff going on.
That's exactly my sense, is that this is a piece that is intended to humanize a person who comes across as not entirely
likable.
I'm so
vehemently against it, and I know I'm wrong. I know the rest of the country doesn't feel the way I do. But for me, when I saw Hillary Clinton trying to take a subway, when I know that gal had not driven her own car in 20 years, let alone ridden a subway, when I saw Mitt Romney going to the burger joint in Iowa and having those awkward, it was painful to watch him talk. And there's nothing wrong with it. Mitt, you're a wealthy guy. You are a very technocratic guy. You have a big family. You are a likable person with your family and whatnot. But no, you don't hang out with diners in Iowa. And you don't roll up your sleeves. And they don't need to ask that stuff. I can't stand it. But everybody loves it. Like, oh, well, he's like one of us. And I'm like, he eats his dinner off of China.
Yeah.
He is not like you.
Well, it's a feature of democracy, though, isn't it? And I when I say democracy, I spread that broadly to any nation state that requires the public's consent at some level. Even Vladimir Putin has to pretend that he's one of the guys, right? Riding a horse bare-chested and wrestling tigers or something.
I think that's who he is.
Not apparently since 2012, when he apparently had a horse riding accident and has been gimpy ever since. There's big story back there, but I go listen to a great podcast, David. If you have a moment when you're sitting on a plane and you really want to play Wordle or single shooter games, there's a podcast called Eastern Border. And I found this through a guy named Dan Carlin, who's an historian, does hardcore history. But Eastern Border comes out of the Far East. And this guy is a Soviet expert, Russia expert. And it's just absolutely fascinating and has nothing to do with California, just my obsession with all things Russia.
Yeah.
So, anywho, what I meant to just show here is, and I think I've beaten the flog the horse here enough, but Kamala Harris, just a complete cluster still. And then we had stories pop out as well about Dianne Feinstein. Many of our listeners probably already saw this. Here's a story from San Francisco Chronicle, Mercury, I think, actually. Yeah. Colleagues worry Dianne Feinstein is now mentally unfit to serve, citing recent interactions. And this story just went everywhere, especially in the Bay Area.
Now, first of all, say what I texted to you when we shared the story with each other.
Are you really?
Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing, but I think you said, really? Now? I said this in 1994.
That I was worried about her mental state in 1994.
There you go.
And that was not because she's a liberal and I'm a conservative, so I thought it was a clever way to call her dumb. It's because she was literally unhinged in 94.
Tell me.
Oh, her mental faculties have been dropping for so long.
Oh, seriously? You're not...
Let's just go back a couple years.
Okay.
Which is admittedly is not 1994, but people are talking about this right now. It's 2022. Yes. When was the Kavanaugh hearing?
Oh, yeah.
2018.
Yeah.
Just someone, if it's out there, find on YouTube her questioning of Kavanaugh, with the aides having to come up to her and tell her what day it was and did she read it and you did read it and yes, Grandma, we did tell you what where your supper is. And I mean, it was the most awkward, painful thing. And that was 4 years ago.
Well, here's, you know, mentioning that, here's a line from the Mercury story. A month, 2020, she repeated a question to a witness word for word in a hearing with seemingly no awareness of having done so. And then she shocked colleagues at the end of the contentious Supreme Court confirmation hearing for Amy Coney Barrett by unexpectedly praising Republicans for having conducted a great process. That's how you know she's crazy. She actually said thank you to the Republicans. She said then, this has been one of the best set of hearings I've participated in. Then she told the Republican chair of the committee, I want to thank you for your fairness. And that's when Dems knew, she's lost her damn mind. So this is a serious story, and the Mercury does a, you know, they say here four U.S. senators, including three Democrats, as well as three former Feinstein staffers and a California Democratic member of Congress, told the Chronicle in recent interviews her memory is rapidly deteriorating. They said it appears she can no longer fulfill her job duties without her staff doing much of the work required to represent nearly 40 million people of California. This is sort of terrifying. In the course of their story, the Mercury writes, each of these sources spoke on condition of anonymity because they said they did not want to jeopardize their relationship with her and their mutual friends and colleagues. So it's unfortunate, but that's sort of the way it is, that if you're going to criticize somebody in this intimate way and say, like, look, you're just not up to the game anymore, then you're going to have to keep your name out of the story because you're afraid you're going to get targeted. Now, the other reason for anonymity is that you may have other motives, which is certainly what her supporters are saying. The chief supporter among these is Nancy Pelosi. Senator Feinstein is a workhorse for the people of California, a respected leader among her colleagues. She's constantly traveling between California and the Capitol, working relentlessly to ensure California's needs are met. And then listen to this. She says, it's unconscionable that just weeks after losing her beloved husband of more than four decades and after decades of outstanding leadership to our city and state, she's being subjected to these ridiculous attacks that are beneath the dignity in which she has led and the esteem in which she is held.
All right.
So you've got Pelosi doubling down and saying that a 90-year-old woman.
Well, and by the way, you recall that is exactly the dignity that the left treated Ronald Reagan with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right.
First of all, she does not deserve to be picked on because she's a leftist or because she's old. I only bring it up because her age is clearly correlated right now to a declining ability to do her job.
Right.
And the people who are leaking this and talking about it are not on my side of the aisle.
No, I think this is true. You were the guy who pointed out, I think rightly, again, Nick Sayer, great listener and commenter on the show, says, like, look, you know, he's commenting on your observation that the whole thing about Kamala is to set Newsom up, to give him a clear avenue, a clear shot at the Democratic nomination. Biden doesn't run, get Kamala pushed aside because of her low poll ratings, continually ridicule her. That's coming from the left primarily. Ditto for this moment where, you know, if you really read through a number of the stories, I'll put one of these up in the show notes. Let's say this one here. Who will follow Feinstein? This is from the San Francisco Standard. Deep in the story, we see that they're starting to look at who can replace her already. Like, so Feinstein's got to be moved out. Newsom will get have the right, the responsibility to appoint her replacement. Who should he appoint? So one of the people that they name here as a potential replacement is Barbara Lee. She's the Bay Area Democrat who's in the Congress. So they're saying that Lee works best because she's older and therefore she's 75. And therefore, let me see. Yes, quote, her appointment would not only put a black woman back in the U.S. Senate after Kamala Harris resigned to become VP, but it would also fulfill a promise the governor has made on numerous occasions. Again, the got to have a black woman in these key roles. Lee's time in office would likely last only years rather than decades, giving Newsom a potential path to national office. But they're not talking about president. They're saying that at some point he may need to run for Senate, a political strategist tells him. It would be stupid to close off that option and name somebody young who would therefore be a constant incumbent candidate for U.S. Senate from California. So Newsom, keeping his options open, they're saying, will be able to appoint someone and will likely go, this will be the signal, go look to see whether he appoints someone young or old. If it's older, the fix, this reporter would argue, is in. Newsom is keeping open the option of becoming a U.S. senator from California. Speaking of Newsom, let's, one of the just most fun reading experiences I had was a little piece by Nate Hockman over at National Review. Headline, Gavin Newsom talks about red states more than California. The story makes him really look, I think, effectively and legitimately like California's Trump. The guy spends so much time on Twitter bashing red states. And according to Nate over National Review, does that more readily, more frequently than he writes about what's going on in California. He samples a few of them. Here's, you know, Newsom blasting Oklahoma for its abortion laws and calling them shameful. Here he is saying that Alabama is following the lead of Texas and Florida and creating hateful laws that will harm kids. We've got him reading banned books to figure out what these states are so afraid of, ignoring completely, Newsom always does, the fact that book banning also occurs on the left. We can't have Mark Twain and, you know, Tom Sawyer or Huck Finn read in our schools or...
It happens both ways.
Yeah, To Kill a Mockingbird. It goes on and on and on. Apparently, Newsom writes, I think, like three times as often about other states as he does about California. So before we move on to a few other state politics, I just wanted to mark the passing, consider this sort of an historical moment for us. Art Roop, who brought rhythm and blues to the mainstream, dies at 104. He was in Santa Barbara when he died at age 104. 104. Now, the reason I know about Art Roop is two things, two sort of tributaries. The confluence of these two things is my time running an alt weekly newspaper in which we wrote a lot about music and music history. And Art Roop eventually goes on to make so much money, not just in music, but all, and I'll come back to that, but also in oil investments here in California and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And set up with some of his proceeds, set up the Roop Foundation, which is still based in Santa Barbara and is a supporter of many, many center-right organizations, including California Policy Center. So his generosity helped us along the way over the years. Just a phenomenal guy. And the most interesting thing about Art Roop is his music career. Like, he comes to California in 1939, sets up a company eventually called Specialty Records. Specialty because his specialty was this niche of black artists coming out of the South or big cities and producing a kind of music that big music companies and radio stations were just ignoring. So think about this: by the 50s, when Specialty Records is really taking off, Art is signing to the label people like Sam Cooke, who would, you know, go on to become part of Sam and Dave, Soul Man, that sort of thing. I mean, just really awesome. Little Richard was a young, unknown artist when he signed him. He was a cross-dresser in clubs in the South, and so he signs Little Richard, and of course everybody knows like Lucille and Good Golly Miss Molly. Percy Mayfield, who wrote the song Hit the Road Jack, which is later Ray Charles, I think, makes that song pretty prominent. Lloyd Price, who wrote Lottie, Miss Claudie, and that's an Elvis cover. So all these, he brought black music to white audiences by really aggressively promoting their music. A phenomenal guy. He had one big miss, and that was Little Richard called him from London to say, "Oh my gosh, I've just seen these guys. You've got to sign them. They're four amazing guys." And according to the story I heard, it's mentioned here in the New York Times piece as well. Art said, four British guys singing rock and roll, it's just not really my thing. You know, I do this other thing, Little Richard. You know, I'm only interested in you. And Little Richard says, "Nah, these guys, the Beatles, they're going to be huge." And Art says, "Yeah, nah, I don't think so." So, go with God, Art Roop, just a really remarkable guy and a Californian, you know, by he adopted California in 1939, long before a young Will Swain was ever born.
A life well lived.
Yeah, no kidding. So I want to talk to you about a couple of like, you know, more like policy stories here if we can. You and I have talked about Gavin Newsom's deep desire to make California an abortion tourism destination. Mm-hmm. By offering free travel and free accommodations and even free abortion services here in California. When I say free, of course I mean not free. They are paid for by all of us in California, so that people who are in such benighted places, quote unquote benighted, hear me, please hear the sarcasm, as Texas or Florida, can now travel here safely to California for free and have an abortion. So here's Yelp, the San Francisco-based company. Yelp, everybody knows Yelp, will pay for its employees to travel for abortion access. Yelp announced on Tuesday, this is last Tuesday, that it would cover expenses for its employees and their spouses who must travel out of state for abortion care. So for its employees and spouses who must travel out of state for abortion care, becoming the latest company to respond to a Texas law that bans the procedure after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. The story notes that last month, Citigroup became the first major bank to disclose that it'll pay travel costs for employees affected by the law in Texas, where it has 8,000 workers. Other companies have announced plans aimed at mitigating the impact of the law, include Uber and Lyft. Now, there's a thing here about how Uber and Lyft are handling this that I think is a nuance worth illuminating a little bit, and that is that they're offering to pay legal fees for Texas drivers who could be sued for taking someone to an abortion clinic. Remember that Senate Bill 8 says anybody who aids or abets in an abortion can be sued under the state's new abortion law. And I think covering the possibility that your drivers are driving a person who does not look pregnant and doesn't announce to you, hey, I'm going to go get an abortion, is worth protecting for a company. They don't want their drivers, in other words, worried about having to ask a whole series of questions that could be very invasive. Like, hey, Mr. Swaim, are you going to go get an abortion? No, I'm not. I'm a guy. Well, I can't really even ask that either. So that's one thing. But this other thing of Yelp doing the sort of, I think, Newsome identitarian thing is fascinating to me. Any thoughts?
Well, you know that I think most of these things are just non-virtue signaling. It's some sort of this is when you're on the verge of breakdown in a society. Is never at the resurgence of bad activity, it's the celebration of bad activity. So I think it's bad enough if it's true that there are workers of companies out there that are like, God, I want to have an abortion and I'm going to go on a road trip to do it. Like, I would consider this a bad thing, because I am a pro-lifer, and I also think people sitting around plotting at work where they're going to go on a road trip to find one is really sad and upsetting. But when you get to a point where a company says, like, hey, we got to go press release that we're going to cover the cost. Like, hey, my aunt just died. She helped raise me. I can't get to see her. Will you cover my cost?
No.
Well, are you going to kill a baby while you're there? I'm not. Well, then no. So you don't care about helping people who are struggling with travel costs. You care about advertising the fact that you're really big fans of baby killing. So what you are is you're disgusting human beings. Okay? This is not about political difference. It's the taunting of immorality. The taunting. What are they doing? Isn't Yelp a restaurant review website?
Mostly.
What are they doing? Playing into this culture war issue.
Here's Yelp.
Yeah. Just stop this nonsense.
Yelp reminds me of the old joke. I'll paraphrase. It's, do you serve babies here? Sure. How do you like them cooked?
What if I said, I have to travel to go have a baby? Is that okay?
For me, that's every day at 4.
Yeah. I think this is disgusting. And it's another example, I suspect, where it'll backfire. Because I don't think they needed to do anything to get their wokey woke people in San Francisco all happy with whatever wokey woke things they're doing. Yet it is in the New York Times, and you and I are talking about it, and it draws attention to other people that were fine to just go review what they thought of the chicken burrito at, Al's Taco Stand. That's what they thought Yelp was.
Mm-hmm.
And now they find out it's running a taxi service for abortion. I mean, what the hell are we even talking about? Dear Lord.
Oh, my gosh. I know there's a joke here with the sticker that says baby on board.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
I would honestly, if I was a person not looking to have an abortion and I saw this announcement go out, I would come up with so many T&E requests. Like, hey, guys, thanks for that new policy. That's really a charitable offer of you guys. I can't make it to my high school reunion this weekend, but I really miss some of my friends and have them turn down all of the requests so that it forces them in the box of saying anything related to visiting family, friends, the infirm. You want to go build a mission. I'm going to Mexico to build a mission. I want to go build a school.
An orphanage.
In El Salvador.
Right.
Can you guys cover that?
No. Nah.
Again, only if there will be babies killed.
That's right.
I mean, this is just disgusting.
I am going to an orphanage. Yeah. I can make this happen.
And obviously, they don't care about it. It's not like we have a problem with employees being denied access to abortion. None of this is a real thing. They are doing it to press release it. That's the worst part of it. It is the celebration of the event. You only have very few things you can bring up to get me going, but this is one of them. Because I don't like virtue signaling when someone's like, hey, I'm going to go to great effort to show that I'm against racism. And I, what's the great effort? Like, what are you doing? This is dangerous stuff. What are you doing? Oh, I posted on Instagram. And you're like, really? Like, that's what you did? And I think that stuff is just pharisaical. I think all the mask wearing has been this big. I assume we're talking about that, by the way.
Yeah.
I think it's been one big exercise in showmanship and just nonsense. Well, but this is virtue signaling out of non-virtue. Like, we want to show the world, you know, how just screwed up we are. It's just not good.
Talk to me about the I assume you're referencing not the COVID childhood vaccine mandate, which we'll get to in a sec, but the decision of a federal judge that the mask mandate on all forms of public transit, including airlines, has just been shot down.
Well, it's a really good thing, Will, that I'm not a conspiracy theorist,
because
I'm not. And I detest conspiracy theorists, and I think they're mostly crazy.
Yeah. But
I will tell you, if I were a conspiracy theorist, which I'm not, and I do not really believe this.
I'm putting the coffee down.
But it would have been a great solution for the Biden administration to get this judge to issue this edict. Because all hell broke loose when they extended the mask mandate. And it was the worst thing for the politics of this that anyone on the left, they're already about to walk into a buzzsaw in November. And there is not a person left of any repute or reasonability that is sitting around going, I'll tell you, I really just think we're not doing enough about COVID. I think we need more restrictions. Let's shut down some more businesses. Let's restrict mobility. Let's do this or that. Like, everyone's on the same boat where not everyone is saying, okay, it turns out David and Will were right a year and a half ago. Most people are not, and most people will never say that, and that's okay. Well, the history books will. Mm-hmm. I'll come back to that. The history books will be on our side, that this was a colossal failure of public policy.
Mm-hmm.
However, right now, all I can tell you is since the holidays, since Omicron, everything did change. And the Democrats knew. The governors of Connecticut, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, they all said, okay, like, this is not going well.
Right.
And then the CDC decides to come out and go, well, yeah, okay, so you can all just walk out and about, and there's no more vax mandates, and Kyrie Irving can play in the playoffs, and everyone can have their lives back, and we're getting the economy going, and got to deal with inflation a little here, but we're doing our part, and let's not have people so mad at us anymore about schools and churches and the businesses. And then the CDC comes out in the end of April. This thing's been dead forever. It was the Super Bowl was like 4 months ago, and Magic's out hugging mayors, and they're all mask free and just coughing and breathing and all the things free people do every day. And everyone knows, hey, did you get Omicron? Yeah, I got it like 5 times. My friends got it. Everyone die? No, not a single person. Oh, you're all good? You're healthy? Yes. So we all got Omicron. We all got a cold. We all got better. Some people had no symptoms. No, everyone's over it. They're over it, over it, over it. I can't say it enough. They're done. And the CDC says we're extending mask mandates. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this judge comes yesterday and says, yeah, this federal ban on masks, this federal mandate for masks doesn't pass muster. Now, the judge's ruling was brilliant, was right on all counts. And no, I do not believe there was coordination with the Biden administration. But I do believe that the second the judge issued the verdict, the Biden administration said, thank you, God.
Yeah.
And that they have no intention of really actually fighting it. There are stories all over social media. I assume you've seen them, of when it came out midstream. Because then my thought was, oh, this bureaucracy. Is it going to take American Airlines like 2 weeks to say, okay, we've looked at it, we've talked to the lawyers, and we're going to slowly bubble. In the middle of a flight,
yes,
they were saying, take your mask off. By a friend of mine, who I didn't get his permission to say his name, but he was on a flight last night. He said the flight attendants were going up and down the aisle with their phones, recording people taking their masks off and celebrating.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is a great thing, obviously. It's so far overdue. I'm not going to give any credit to anybody. This thing should have never been in place. It was absurd. The forcing of babies off of planes because they couldn't keep a mask on. It was abusive. It was arbitrary. And then I think we've talked about, with the intimacy of the Radio Free California listeners, when I was the subject of a federal investigation. I was on the top most wanted list.
Yeah.
And I was vindicated.
Oh, it's good to know a celebrity. Yeah, so I'm intrigued by this and by the fact that almost simultaneously we have a we have Senator Richard Pan, who's from the Bay Area, a physician who we've talked about at some length, so I won't repeat the whole dread story right here. But Pan was the author of multiple just really authoritarian COVID restrictions, including, I think most infamously, two bills, one which is still alive, the other one which he just pulled this week. Friday, we're recording Tuesday morning. But on Friday, late Friday afternoon, that's when you hit the media soft spot because everybody's signing off on Friday afternoon. So if you want to kill a story, it's well known in newsrooms. Make sure the press releases go out on a Friday afternoon. Pan quietly pulled a bill that would have required all school age kids, 5 years and older, unless they are in TK classes, that is transitional kindergarten, in which case it could be even three or four, presumably. But this was a bill in which he proposed that all these kids who are the least likely to catch, transmit, get hospitalized for, or die from COVID, he quietly pulled the bill. And I just want to point out that California Policy Center's parent union was, you know, we work every day with the leaders of about 25 of the largest parent organizations around the state, and we help coordinate activities and best practices. And these groups run from the far left progressives to very conservative parent groups. And it was a full court press last week. We at CPC, we launched a petition drive. We got 3,000 signatures in under 20 hours. We got people to email their lawmakers and tell them what they think. We have to be very careful as a 501c3, and we were. We just said, hey, what do you think about forcing five-year-olds to get vaccinated for this disease? And hundreds and hundreds of people popped into that system to email directly or phone call their lawmakers. And the pressure just became very intense. I was talking to a couple of people up in the Senate and the Assembly who just said, man, they were getting inundated by angry parents from whom they have never before heard. People who just said, this is a step too far to force kids who are not vulnerable to this disease to get one more shot, the effects of which we really don't understand. Can we just give these kids a pass? So he pulls that bill, which I think is absolutely phenomenal. It's a huge win for parents. And it's, I think this is further evidence, as you say, that the early days of panic, which were legitimate, we've talked about it on this show when my daughter was one of the first people in Orange County to get COVID. And it was terrifying. I was scared, man. I think I actually cried on the show. I was uncomfortable about this. That was a time when we didn't know anything about this. It's like, remember back to the earliest days of AIDS or Ebola or something like that. It was a terrifying experience. And then as we got to know more, we became more, I think, reasonable about it, some of us, especially you with your daily missives on this subject. You played a yeoman's role in this thing every single day, dissecting policy and data and just reminding people about reasonableness. I know how you did it and wrote a book and did this podcast.
Oh, that book came so much later. That's how long this thing's been going on. I mean, it started, the COVID market started, you and me doing special podcasts on it. Mm-hmm. Started 25 months ago, Will. And I will try my best with grace and charity to hold out a distinction between the policies of March, April, May 2020 from everything else. Because I think that there was an uncertainty. I wish there had been more humility. As we find out more information, we do find out there was a little less uncertainty than we were previously mm-hmm, told. Mm-hmm. I do believe they knew from a lot of very, inductive argumentation that COVID was, in fact, very non-fatal to the preponderance of people who would get it. Much earlier than we thought they did.
Yeah, you and I were talking about this in April of 2020, that already, I mean, that was like the first 6 weeks maybe, the evidence was very clear.
And we were saying like, hey, it's a lot of people who could die and we don't want hospitals overrun, but thank God it's only about a 4% fatality rate. Now we know it's going to end up being less than 0.2% when all said and done. Yeah. From an infection basis, total infections as your denominator, total COVID mortalities is your numerator. It is going to be less than 0.2%. The childhood mortality is effectively 0%, effectively. This is all upside down from the Spanish flu, where it was predominantly killing people under the age of 18, awful lot of 500,000 people under the age of 5, which is incomprehensible to me. I think that this is it. I'm done. And I was pretty much done for a long, long time. But then, you know, you couldn't be done. Like, if you fly as much as I do, and then you have to kind of put the mask on. And, I you know, some airlines were a little cooler about it than others, and you had little ways. But once you get to that point, if you go, no, it's okay. Because all you have to do is just hold a water bottle in your hand. And then, right. Then it's like, okay, well, that's great. But why are we doing it at all then?
Right.
If every single person has figured out how to game it, no one takes any of it seriously, it's time for it to go. And that arbitrariness has undermined confidence in public health. It's undermined confidence in anybody's credibility or seriousness. The whole thing with what was it? Was it Garcetti? You said I held my breath when I hugged Magic Johnson
and
stuff
for 40 seconds.
And, you know, my joke was that he thought he was going to get AIDS. and I thought it was so funny, and I got people were mad at me about that one. But that was just a joke because he was hugging a guy with the HIV virus and saying this stupid thing. Obviously, I didn't really think any of this, but I don't think Garcetti thought any of it,
no,
right? It was just the absurdity of the moment. That was the point of my joke. I didn't mean to offend anyone. But you know what, Will? I do think that you were on this with the school unions from day one. I mean, I'm pretty proud of a lot of the work that I did throughout this on the data, and particularly just unpacking the argument. The argument, what theoretically, was we need to borrow trillions of dollars. We need to shut down the economy because they're going to override the hospital systems. And I would have never known if I didn't do the research myself. I was not going to find it in The Atlantic, and I was not going to find it at CNN, that the hospitals were not really being overrun. It was a byproduct of how they were reporting the data, and that they had surge capacity and they had this and that. So the whole thing, and then I don't really know what to say about those who kind of fell in love with their captors. There were a lot of people that just didn't want COVID to end, and most of them are quite affluent and are quite comfortable. They're mostly coastal, and the people are like, hey, I'm just working from home. I got my Peloton. I got my DoorDash. I got my Zoom, and I hate those people.
Mm-hmm.
I freaking hate them. I can't forgive them for it. I hold them in such low regard right now that I don't know when I'm actually going to get over it. And I know people are going to email now, like, you shouldn't hate and you got to forgive. But the point is, metaphorically, what these people have done is worthy of our scorn.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's not just the teacher unions that you focused on. It's culturally this. I believe it's unforgivable that somebody can live in a reality that is so separated from what they're doing, how it's affecting everybody else. And they have no idea.
And not only don't have an idea, but fly under the flag of social justice as they do it. That, you know, this is really to protect the poor. It's really to protect, you know, look at how this is ravaging our Black community or our South Asian Islander population. It was such a lie, because the way in which those people were hurt was through job loss, dislocation. They did not have
apparently human sacrifice, because what they said was, you reading this New York Times article, you reading this Atlantic periodical, you're not safe to go out to the restaurants. You need to order DoorDash because you're going to zip code with a lot of infections. You're going to die.
Right.
And so don't worry. We're sending a poor kid on a bike to bring your food to you.
Right.
What in the world is the logic of that? How's that guy going to survive the COVID massacre?
Yeah. And
but no one ever even thought through this.
No. And the parents who had to stay home with their kids, whether they could afford to or not. You know, I heard somebody recently say that COVID was an epidemic that hurt most grievously women who had to quit their jobs and stay home to take care of children. Well, who created that responsibility, that liability? Certainly wasn't people like you and I. Hey, we only have a few minutes, I think.
Are the teacher unions done?
No, they're still arguing that now what they need is catch-up pay to accommodate the fact that and if they don't get the pay, they're going on strike.
I'm for catch-up pay. They should pay us back for when they were. I'm dead damn serious right now. Don't laugh. If you take a sip of coffee and spit it out right now, I will never record with you again. I'll do catch-up pay. You people owe us a check. That's the catch-up pay. You pay the kids that didn't get a senior year of high school.
Yeah, here's the whole irony of this thing is that, like, you had in Sacramento a teacher strike that lasted so long that now they're facing a court order to add days of school. So all these parents who thought they'd made it through COVID only to have their teachers union, and this is going on all over the state now with teachers unions planning these strikes because they see that it worked here or there, saying we don't make enough. We got no increases during COVID. Look at the stress we were under during COVID. And so the fact is that school years are being extended now into the summer at, you know, some sort of perhaps social cost for parents as well, where families have to adjust things like, okay, we're planning on a holiday, dad's taking off a week. Nope, no more. Long story short, the teachers unions are still leveraging their heroic deployment during COVID as evidence they deserve an increase. And, you know, the remarkable thing in California, I'm sorry to offer this candid view of how the teachers union operates, is that most people really do like their teacher and are only vaguely aware of the way in which the teachers union has become, I would argue, the most racist institution in California. This is an organization that has failed miserably the people they claim most to be concerned about.
But, you know, I think that I've been there with most people for a long time in the reasoning of the teachers are usually pretty heroic, but the unions are the bad guys, mm-hmm. and we got to disempower the unions. And so usually the kind of fat cat stereotype we throw of the superintendents and the bureaucrats and all that. Mm-hmm. I don't think the teachers acted heroically either. I know some did. But for the most part, this whole thing of the teachers are our heroes, we've talked about before. I'm no longer like the word hero applied to someone who isn't like literally, you know, shooting a gun, saving kids
saving
and lives.
Yeah.
And there's a context that I would like to honor when we talk about heroic action. But no, I think a lot of the teachers in Chicago Unified, LA Unified should be ashamed of themselves.
Gosh, from your lips to God's ears. Hey, do we have time to talk about Disney?
Well, we always have time to talk about Disney because, you know what? We have to support business
yeah.
and anything they do. And I got to find a lobbyist to help with this cause.
I know a guy. So here's the big headline is, I'm walking into your office, and of course you have massive TV screens all over the place. And there was news on a lot of the screens there that DeSantis is now pushing for an end to Disney's right to basically own and operate the area around its Orlando parks as its own entity, like a special district, if you will, in which Disney is the de facto government, you know, providing fire service and landscaping and sewage and water and everything else in that community. And we could get into the deep history about why that's so, which stretches back to Anaheim's growth right around Disneyland, which limited what Walt Disney could do with that park. And so in Florida, Walt Disney was really concerned to make sure that he had the total planning control. Disney was a very conservative guy, a very free market guy, of course. But the company that still bears his name has become so woke, of course, and all of our listeners know about this, but has decided that it has to join the LGBTQIA+ effort and really shout down. Disney has committed itself to actually repeal Florida's parental rights bill, which they call the Don't Say Gay bill. And I would just point out to Disney, hey, you should just declare victory and walk away, because the bill doesn't say gay anywhere. It just says you can't talk to kids about sex before the fourth grade, a proposition that is widely popular in Florida, if the polls are to be believed. But Disney has committed itself, this family entertainment company has committed itself to this particular initiative and its destruction. And in doing so, has, you know, really finally roused to real ire Governor Ron DeSantis, who is this morning saying, you know what, we're going to take a real critical look at Disney's ownership. I think it's called Reedy Creek, the Reedy Creek District, which was set up again for and by Disney and the Florida state government in the 60s. So first of all, what do you think of that? And then I want to get to a real interesting change here in Disney's corporate structure here in LA. So what do you think, first of all, about DeSantis and his stand on this?
I'm really proud of him. I'm really supportive. I'm really impressed. I think he's drawn the line. I don't think he would have needed to do it if Disney left well enough alone. I think the original posture the CEO planned to take was the posture that they should have taken, and then he got bullied into it by a 25-year-old. So I still remain mystified by how you become CEO of a company worth hundreds of billions of dollars and you can't stand up to a 25-year-old. And yet now Disney wanted to pick this fight, and DeSantis is going the next round. I have no problem with it.
So let me play devil's advocate.
Yeah.
I know you hate even the phrase, but let's look at this from a free market perspective.
Yeah.
You know, this is a real experiment in free market economy that is giving Disney its right to plan this area. And of course, now that the roles have reversed and you've got the lefties saying, how dare you intrude on this corporate right to monitor its own land use planning and fire service, public safety, et cetera. How dare you? But this whole enterprise looks like it grew up in a, you know, Reason Foundation think tank meeting or something. It's a very libertarian approach to corporate governance and governance in the public space. You create private public space. Could DeSantis be held up as expanding the scope of government?
I thought you meant in general, in the weeds of the particular policy actions. I do not think that contract law should be nullified. If agreements are in place, and there is not legal preconditions for violating them, I wouldn't support that. What I'm talking about in general is a company that has lived off of the largesse of the public forever. This stuff in Anaheim, that, as you know, is basically why I quit the Lincoln Club, because I could not support us cozying up to these idiots in Anaheim that were giving away parking structures and stadiums,
transportation
and subsidies and waivers on hotel taxes that the little guy didn't get. And they were defending it with my arguments. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, we're pro-business. We're pro-growth.
Right.
That's cronyism. And it's so wrong to the cause of free enterprise. So all I'm getting at with DeSantis is Disney has decided to go after Florida as an evil actor in the culture war. And I think DeSantis at a high level is right to push back at Disney as one who is in a lot of positions of receipt. Mm-hmm. Of public-private
largesse.
Activities.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But then to the scrutiny of each individual transaction and arrangement, I would, as a conservative, I would be slow to unwind anything and would want to conserve contracts and agreements and yet do very thorough due diligence as to what the future relationship would look like.
Well, in fairness to DeSantis and getting into the weeds just a little bit, I'll say that there's loads out there, and maybe I can put up one of the stories in the show notes, but there is a lot of stuff here that DeSantis has clearly looked at in a very lawyerly way, which is that this agreement with Disney was set up in 67, and state law says that any contract like this that precedes 1968 must be ratified again and again in regular cycles. And he's just saying, look, this time it's over. We're not going to, you know, re-up this contract with Disney.
Yeah, so then the question is, are we just conveniently doing that because Disney's done something? Well, I'm sorry, but maybe we are.
Mm.
I would not be in favor of breaking a law over this public spat. But if the law requires an ongoing look, there's a reason for the need for ongoing look. And so DeSantis, it sounds like, within his rights. That's different than that other silliness that I think you have
the copyright. Yeah.
You know, the Republicans saying we want to go take away the copyright of Mickey Mouse or something.
Right.
I'm sorry, but that kind of stuff is just nonsense.
Yeah. One last piece on Disney. You sent it to me. Christina Shake, I think that's how we pronounce her name, S-C-H-A-K-E, named Executive VP Global Communications of Walt Disney Corporation. David,
I thought I was getting played, man. I thought it was a joke.
Tell me.
Oh, I sent you her just the bio.
Yeah.
It's just the press release of who they hire.
Yes.
What's her exact title? I don't have it in front of me. Director
of
Global
Communications. Executive Vice President, Global Communications of the Walt Disney Company.
And then she's been just the most hack of a Democrat, extreme liberal activist. Worked for the Obama administration, the Clinton campaign. Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And so this notion of Disney as this kind of, you know, benign political actor. I mean, it isn't like, look, if they have their head of revenue strategy or something, and they happen to be a liberal, and then they have another executive happens to be a conservative, and I don't think people can connect dots there. The point is, she's a global communications expert whose job is essentially spin and government relations,
yes,
and PR, and her very function in life has been to do so for far left causes.
Yeah, well, so here's let me just make, you know, you don't have to connect dots. Here's the explicit reason Disney hired her. They want, Disney has said they are committed to the repeal of the parental rights bill in Florida. They have hired a woman who is from California to come back to California from Washington, D.C., government affairs work, as you said, for a long list of Democrats in the White House or who aspire to be in the White House. She's coming back here to the state where she led the campaign against Proposition 8. Now, I opposed and continue to oppose Proposition 8. For those who don't remember it, Proposition 8 legalized gay marriage. This is my very libertarian streak, and I hope I do not mean to offend when I say, look, man, I don't have a dog in the fight of other people's personal relationships when they are non-exploitive or coercive at that level. That's not the state's role. My church would never sanctify that marriage.
No, no, the whole thing, look, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole either, but for some reason you did.
Because she ran the campaign against it.
No, I understand that, but I just want to be fair to the people who do support Prop 8. You don't believe that because you don't support legalized polygamy, and those are consensual adults as well.
Actually, I would.
Okay, so then you're taking the reductio ad absurdum.
I am.
The defenders of gay marriage would usually say, no, that's where I put my foot down.
Right.
And they would do so very logically under the pretense of how it affects children to have five mothers and three fathers and things. So that's fine.
Better than no fathers and mothers.
Either way, the concept of consent being the standard of marriage is a very new idea in Western civilization.
Yes.
And so you have your views on it, and your point was simply that she was fighting on your side of Prop 8 and was knee-deep in the culture war in that issue, and now is the head of global communications at Disney.
For a company that wants to tear down another, you know, I would argue, sort of family-friendly, pro-family, pro-parent, really. That's all this bill is. It just says parents are the authority in these things.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about, you know, minor children and the responsibility of parents, to me, very, very different thing. But she has deep experience, and that's why Disney's brought her on. You talk about non-virtue signaling. They brought on a person whose politics are perfectly in line with destroying what Ron DeSantis and I would argue, conservatives and even moderates in Florida have decided to set up in this parental rights bill. That's
I'd like more Fortune 50 companies, Fortune 100 companies to post the pedigree of their global communications executive vice president. I got a feeling you're going to find a lot of Obama alumni in there.
Seriously.
A lot of anti-Prop 8 alumni in there.
Hmm.
A lot of Biden, you know, government relations people in there. I think this is permeating corporate America. They're all hacks for the same cause. So, Will, what do you and all your wives think about this?
I can only manage one,
yeah.
And she can only manage one husband.
I'm not going to say his name because he didn't give me permission, but one of the wealthiest people I know and one of my dear friends once said he wanted a sticker. Legalize polygamy. I need a third income. I got to go.
All right. That's all the time we have today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and better for us if you just subscribe and rate and review the show wherever you do subscribe. That helps boost our profile and helps others find us. You can email us with your comments and story suggestions. You'll find our personal email addresses and other fun details in the show notes. You can follow us on Twitter at the Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend and co-host, David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, and all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi and metal band. They supply our music. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima.